NAACP, and later the same for the ACLU. He had represented unions, a rarity in rural North Mississippi. He sued the state over the lousy schools for blacks. He sued the state over capital punishment. He sued the city because it refused to pave the streets in Lowtown. Until he was disbarred, Lucien Wilbanks had been a fearless lawyer who never hesitated to fire off a lawsuit when he thought one was needed and never failed to help a client who was being mistreated. On the sidelines now for the past 11 years, Lucien was still a loyal friend who reveled in Jake's success. If asked, there was no doubt in Jake's mind that Lucien would advise him to not only take on the defense of young Drew Gamble, but to do so with as much noise as possible. Proclaim innocence. Demand a speedy trial. Lucien had always believed that every person charged with a serious crime deserved a good lawyer. And Lucien had never, throughout his colorful career, dodged the attention that a bad client could bring. Jake's other close friend, Harry Rex, had already weighed in, and there was no reason to revisit the question with him. Carla was on the fence. Noose was waiting by the phone. He wasn't worried about the Kofers. He didn't know them and believed they lived in the southern part of the county. Jake was 37 years old and had practiced law successfully for 12 years without that family. He could certainly prosper in the future without knowing them. He was thinking about the cops, the city policeman, and Ozzie and his deputies. 6 days a week, Jake had breakfast 4 doors down at the coffee shop, and Marshall Prather was often there, waiting with the morning's first insult. Jake had done legal work for many on the force and knew that he was their favorite lawyer. Duane Looney had testified against Carl Lee Haley and had stunned the jury by admitting he admired the man who blew off his leg. Mick Swayze had a crazy cousin that Jake had successfully shipped off to the state mental hospital at no charge. Granted, the legal work wasn't much, wills and deeds and small stuff that Jake charged little for. Pro bono work was not unusual. As he studied the ceiling fan, he had to admit that not a single law enforcement officer had ever brought him a decent case. And wouldn't they understand if he represented Drew? Sure, they were in shock at the murder of a colleague, but they realized that someone, some lawyer, had to represent the accused. Might they feel better if the lawyer was Jake, a friend they trusted? Was he about to make a courageous decision or the biggest mistake of his career? He finally walked to his desk, picked up the phone, and called Carla. Then he called Judge Noose. Chapter 6. It was dark when he left the office, and even darker as he walked around the deserted square. It was almost 8 on a Sunday night, and not a single store or cafe was open. The jail, however, was bristling with activity. As he turned down the street and saw the fleet of patrol cars parked haphazardly around the buildings and the news trucks, one from Tupelo, one from Jackson, and the crowd of men loitering outside smoking and talking quietly, a sharp pain hit low in his stomach. He felt as though he was walking directly into enemy territory. He knew the layout well and decided to duck down a side street and enter the sprawling office complex through a rear door. The buildings had been enlarged and renovated over time, and with no clear plan as to what might be constructed next. Along with the 20 or so cells and holding rooms and reception areas and cramped hallways, the complex housed the Sheriff's Department on one end and the Clanton City Police on the other. For the sake of simplicity, all of it was simply referred to as the jail. And on that dark night, the jail was packed with every person even remotely connected to law enforcement. It was indeed a brotherhood, the comfort in being with others who wore the badge. A jailer told Jake that Ozzie was in his office with the door locked, Jake asked him to inform the sheriff that he needed to speak with him and would wait outside near the yard, a fenced area where the inmates often played basketball and checkers. In good weather, Jake and the other lawyers in town would sit on an old picnic table under a tree and chat with their clients through the chain-link fence. At night, though, the yard was dark, as all prisoners were locked away. Their small cell windows were secured by rows of thick bars. At that moment, Jake had no clients serving time in the jail, other than his latest one. He had two boys at the state penitentiary at Parchman, both for selling drugs. One had a mother with a big mouth and was blaming Jake for their family's demise. A door opened and Ozzy appeared, alone. He strolled over in no hurry, as if his shoulders were weighted, as if he hadn't slept in days. Instead of extending a hand, he cracked his knuckles and gazed across the yard.
"Rough day," Jake said.
Ozzy grunted and said,
"The worst one yet. Got the call at 3 this morning and haven't slowed down since. It's tough losing a deputy, Jake."
"I'm sorry, Ozzy. I knew Stu and liked him. I can't imagine what you guys are going through."
"He was a great guy. Kept us all in stitches. Maybe a darker side, but we can't talk about that."
"And you've met with his family?" Ozzy took a deep breath and shook his head.
"I drove out, paid my respects. They're not the most stable people I've met. They've called here this afternoon asking about the boy. Two of them showed up at the hospital, said they wanted to talk to the boy's mother. Crazy stuff like that. So now I've got a deputy parked outside her room. You better watch these guys, Jake."
Just what the little Brigance family needed, more crazies to worry about. Ozzy cleared his throat and spat on the ground.
"I just talked to Noose."
"So did I," Jake said. "He wouldn't take no."
"He told me he leaned on you, said you didn't want to get involved."
"Who would, Ozzy? Certainly nobody from around here. Noose promised me he would try to find a lawyer from outside the county, so I'm just sort of standing in for the preliminaries. At least that's the plan."
"You don't sound too sure."
"I'm not. These cases are not easy to get rid of, especially when the rest of the bar goes into hiding and won't take calls from the judge. There's a good chance I'll get stuck with it."
"Why couldn't you just say no?"
"Because Noose is standing on my neck, and because there's no one else. Not now, anyway. It's hard to say no to a circuit judge, Ozzy."
"Sounds like it."
"He pushed pretty hard."
"Yeah, that's what he said. I guess we're on opposite sides here, Jake."
"Aren't we usually on opposite sides? You bring them in, I try to get them off. Both doing our jobs."
"I don't know. This seems different. I've never buried a deputy before. Then we'll have a trial, a big one. And you'll do what good lawyers are supposed to do. Get the kid off, right?"
"That day is far away, Ozzy. I'm not thinking about a trial right now."
"Try thinking about a funeral."
"I'm sorry, Ozzy."
"Thanks. Should be a fun week."
"I need to see the kid." Ozzy nodded to a row of windows on the backside of the jail's most recent addition.
"Right there."
"Thanks. Do me a favor, Ozzy. Marshall, Moss, Duane, those guys are my friends, and they won't like this at all."
"You got that right."
"So at least be honest and tell them that Noose appointed me, and that I didn't ask for the case."
"I'll do that."
The jailer opened the door and switched on a dim light. Jake followed him inside as his eyes tried to refocus in the semi-darkness. He had been in the juvie cell before, many times. The normal procedure would have been to handcuff the inmate and walk him down the hall to an interrogation room where he would meet face-to-face with his lawyer while a jailer stood guard just outside the door. No one could remember a lawyer being attacked in the jail by his client, but they were cautious nonetheless. There was a first time for everything, and the clientele was not the most predictable. However, it was obvious to Ozzy and the jailer that this inmate posed no threat. Drew had completely withdrawn and refused all food. He had said nothing since his sister left 12 hours earlier. The jailer whispered,
"Shall I leave the door open just in case?"
Jake shook his head no, and the jailer left, closing the door behind him. Drew was still on the bottom bunk, using as little space as possible. Under a thin blanket, he was curled with his knees to his chest and his back to the door, wrapped tight and warm in his own little dark cocoon. Jake pulled over a plastic stool and sat down, making as much noise as possible. The kid did not flinch, did nothing to acknowledge the presence of his visitor. Jake adjusted to the utter stillness, then coughed and said,
"Say, Drew, my name is Jake. Are you there? Anybody home?"
"Nothing. I'm a lawyer, and the judge has assigned me to your case.
I'll bet you've met a lawyer before, right, Drew?"
"Nothing."
"Okay. Well, you and I need to be friends, because you're about to spend a lot of time with me, and with the judge, and with the court system. You ever been to court before, Drew?"
"Nothing."
"Something tells me that you've been to court."
"Nothing."
"I'm a good guy, Drew. I'm on your side."
"Nothing."
A minute passed, then two. The blanket rose and fell slightly as Drew breathed. Jake could not see if his eyes were open. Another minute. Jake said,
"Okay. Can we talk about your mother, Drew? Josie Gamble? You know she's okay, right?"
"Nothing." Then a slight movement under the blanket as he slowly uncurled his legs and stretched them. "And your sister Kira? Let's talk about Josie and Kira. They're both safe right now, Drew. I want you to know this."
"Nothing."
"Drew, we're not getting anywhere here. I want you to turn around and look at me. It's the least you can do. Roll over and say hello, and let's have a chat."
The boy grunted the word,
"No."
"Right, now we're getting somewhere. You can talk after all. Ask me a question about your mother, okay? Anything."
Softly he asked,
"Where is she?"
"Turn around and sit up and look at me when you talk."
He rolled over and sat up, careful not to hit his head on the frame of the top bunk. He pulled the blanket tight around his neck, as if it protected him, and leaned forward with his feet hanging free. Dirty socks, shoes over by the commode. He stared at the floor and huddled under the blanket. Jake studied his face and was certain there had to be a mistake. Drew's eyes were red and puffy from a day spent under the covers and probably no small amount of crying. His blonde hair was wild and in need of a trim. And he was tiny. When Jake was 16 years old, he was the starting quarterback for Caraway High School, 10 miles from Clanton. He also played basketball and baseball and was shaving, driving, and dating every cute girl who would say yes. This kid belonged on a bike with training wheels. Chatter was important, and Jake said, "Paperwork says you're 16 years old, right?"
No response.
"When's your birthday?"
He stared at the floor motionless.
"Come on, Drew. Surely you know your own birthday."
"Where's my mother?"
"She's at the hospital, and she'll be there for a few days. She has a broken jaw, and I think the doctors want to operate. I'm going by there tomorrow to say hello, and I'd like to tell her that you're okay, under the circumstances."
"She's not dead?"
"No, Drew. Your mother is not dead. What do you want me to say to her?"
"I thought she was dead. So did Kira. We both thought Stu had finally killed her. That's why I shot him. What's your name?"
"Jake. I'm your lawyer."
"The last lawyer lied to me.
Sorry about that, but I'm not lying. I swear I don't lie. Ask me something or anything, and I promise I'll give you a straight answer without lying. Try me.
How long will I be in jail?
Jake hesitated and said, I don't know. And that's not a lie. It's truth. Because right now, nobody knows how long you'll stay in jail. A safe answer would be a long time. They're going to charge you with killing Stuart Kofor, and murder is the most serious crime of all. He looked at Jake, and with red, moist eyes said,
But I thought he killed my mother.
I get that. But the truth is, Drew, that he didn't.
I'm still glad I shot him.
I wish you had not.
I don't care if they keep me in prison forever, because he can never hurt my mother again. And he can't hurt Kira, and he can't hurt me. He got what he deserved, Mr. Jake.
It's just Jake, okay? Drew and Jake, lawyer and client. Drew wiped his cheeks with the back of his hand. He closed his eyes tightly and began shaking, shivering as if the chills were sweeping through him. Jake pulled down another thin blanket from the top bunk and draped it over his shoulders. He was sobbing now, shaking and sobbing with tears dripping off his cheeks. He cried for a long time. A small, pitiful, terrified little boy, so utterly alone in the world. More of a little boy than a teenager, Jake thought more than once. When the shaking stopped, Drew went back into his own world and refused to speak, refused to acknowledge Jake's presence. He wrapped himself in the blankets, lay down, and stared blankly at the mattress frame above him. Jake brought up his mother again, but it didn't work. He mentioned food and soft drinks, but there was no response. 10 minutes passed, then 20. When it became apparent that Drew was not going to respond, Jake said, Okay, I'm out of here, Drew. I'll see your mother in the morning and tell her you're doing just great. While I'm away, you are not to speak to anyone else. No jailer, no policeman, no investigator, nobody. You hear? Which, for you, should not be a problem. Just say nothing until I get back. Jake left him much as he had found him, lying still, trance-like, staring wide-eyed, but seeing nothing. He closed the door behind him. At the desk he signed out, avoided some familiar faces, and left the jail on foot for the long walk home. Out of curiosity, he took a detour near the square and saw an office light on, as he'd expected. Harry Rex often locked himself away late at night, especially on Sunday, to catch up with the madness that was his practice. During most days, his dingy waiting room was filled with warring spouses and other unhappy clients, and he spent more time refereeing than settling disputes. In addition to that stress, his fourth marriage was not going well, and he preferred the late-night tranquility of his office over the tension around the house. Jake tapped on a window and entered through a rear door. Harry Rex met him in the kitchen and removed 2 cans of beer from the fridge. They settled into a cluttered workroom beside his office.
Why are you out so late?
He asked. Stop by the jail, Jake said, and Harry Rex nodded as if this was no surprise.
Noose hazed you into it, right?
He did. Said the appointment was only for 30 days, just to get the kid through the preliminaries.
Bullshit! You'll never get rid of this case, Jake, because no one else will take it. I tried to warn you.
You did, but it's pretty hard saying no to the circuit judge, Harry Rex. When was the last time you looked at Noose and said no to a favor?
I stay away from Noose, not my domain. I prefer chancery court, where we don't have juries and the judges are afraid of me.
Chancellor Reuben Attlee is not afraid of anybody. Harry Rex swallowed some beer and looked at Jake in disbelief.
He took another swallow and kicked back in an old wooden swivel. He had lost 50 pounds the year before, but had now regained at least that much. And because of his bulk, he struggled to lift both feet to the table. But they made it, in ragged old jogging shoes that Jake could swear he'd been wearing for at least the past decade. Feet in place, cold beer in hand, he continued pleasantly.
A really stupid move on your part.
I may have stopped by for a beer, but not for any abuse. As if he didn't hear him, Harry Rex said,
My phone has been ringing all day as the gossip spread, and I heard from people I thought were dead, hoped most of them were anyway, but seriously, a murdered deputy? This county has never seen one of those, and so folks are prattling away right now. And tomorrow, and the next day, and the rest of the week, that's all this town will talk about. How much they all love Stuart Cofer. Even the wags who hardly knew him will discover a deep admiration for the guy. And can you imagine the funeral or memorial or whatever Ozzy will put on with the family? Hell, you know how much cops love parades and funeral processions and burials with guns and cannons. It'll be quite the show with the whole town trying to get into the act. And when they're not weeping over Cofer, they'll be vilifying his killer. 16-year-old punk shot him with his own gun in his own bed. Cold-blooded murder. Let's string him up now. As always, Jake, the guilt will rub off on the lawyer. On you. You do your best to represent your client, and they'll hate you for it. It's a mistake, Jake. A big one. You'll regret this case for a long time.
You're assuming too much, Harry Rex. Noose assured me it's only temporary. I'll meet with him Tuesday to discuss the possibility of approaching some of the national child advocacy groups to get some help down here. Noose knows the case is not good for me.
Y'all talk about Smallwood? Of course not. That would be highly inappropriate.
Harry Rex snorted and swallowed more beer. It was unethical to discuss a hotly contested case with the presiding judge when the opposing lawyers knew nothing of the conversation, especially a phone chat on a Sunday afternoon that was initiated for other reasons. But such ethical formalities had never impressed Harry Rex. He said,
Here's what might happen, Jake, and this is my biggest fear. Right now, those sumbitches on the other side of Smallwood are getting nervous. I've convinced Dobie that they don't want to mess with you in your courtroom, in front of a Ford County jury. You're good and all that, but not nearly as good as I've made you out to be. I've blown a lot of smoke up his ass, and he's not much of a trial lawyer anyway. His partner is better, but they're from Jackson, and that can be a long ways off. Sullivan will be sitting at the table with them, but he's not a factor. So we're talking trial dates for Smallwood, and I have a hunch the railroad will start dropping hints about a settlement. However,
a gulp of beer and the can was empty.
Yesterday, you were the golden boy with a fine reputation, but that started changing today. By the end of the week, your good name will be mud because you're trying to spring the kid who murdered our deputy.
I'm not sure it was murder.
You crazy, Jake. Have you been hanging around Lucian again?
No, not today.
It could be insanity. Could be justifiable homicide.
Could be, could be. Let me tell you what it will be. It'll be suicide for you and your law practice in this small and unforgiving town. Even if you keep Noose happy, it'll still kill Smallwood. Can't you see that, Jake?
You're overreacting again, Harry Rex. There are 32,000 people in this county, and I'm sure we can find 12 who've never heard of me or Stuart Cofer. The railroad's lawyers can't point at me in the courtroom and say, Hey, that guy represents cop killers. They can't do that, and Noose won't let them try. Harry Rex jerked his feet down as if he had had enough, and he lumbered out of the room, went to the kitchen, fetched two more beers, and brought them to the table. He popped a top and began pacing along the far end of the table.
Here's your problem, Jake. Your problem is that you want to be the center of attention. That's why you fought to hang on to the Haley case when all the black preachers and organizers and radicals were telling Carl Lee to ditch the white boy before they sent his black ass to parchment. You fought to keep the case, and then you defended him brilliantly. You love it, Jake. I don't expect you to admit it, but you love the big case, the big trial, the big verdict. You love being in the very center of the arena with all eyes on you.
Jake ignored the second can and took a sip from his first.
What's Carla's opinion? Harry Rex asked.
Mixed. She's tired of me carrying a gun. Harry Rex drank some beer and stopped to stare at a bookcase filled with thick, leather-bound law treatises no one in his office had touched in decades. Not even to dust. Without looking at Jake, he asked,
"Did you say the words justifiable homicide?"
"I did."
"So you're already at trial, right, Jake?"
"No. I'm just thinking out loud, just a habit."
"Bullshit. You're already at trial and planning the defense. Did Kofa beat the woman?"
"She's in the hospital with a concussion and a broken jaw that will require surgery."
"Did he beat the kids?"
"I don't know."
"So there was a pattern of Kofa coming home drunk late on Saturday night and slapping everybody around. And the way you see the defense is that you'll, in effect, put him on trial. You'll slander his good name by exposing all of his sins and bad habits."
"It's not slander, if it's true."
"That could be a very nasty trial, Jake."
"I'm sorry I mentioned it, Harry Rex. I don't plan on being anywhere near that courtroom."
"Now you're lying."
"No. I think about trials because I'm a lawyer, but this one is for someone else. I'll get through the preliminary stuff, then unload the kid."
"I doubt that. I truly doubt that, Jake. I just hope you're not screwing up Smallwood. Truthfully, I really don't give a damn what happens to Stuart Kofa or his girlfriends and kids and people I've never met, but I do care about Smallwood. That case could be the biggest payday in our lousy little careers."
"I don't know. I got $1,000 for the Haley case."
"And that's about all you'll get for this turkey, too."
"Well, at least we have Noose on our side.
For now, I don't trust him as much as you do."
"Have you ever met a judge you trusted?"
"No, nor a lawyer."
"Look, I gotta go. I need a favor."
"A favor? Right now, I'd like to choke you."
"Yeah, but you won't. Tomorrow morning at 6, I'll walk into the coffee shop and say hello to Marshall Prather. Same routine. Might be another deputy or two at the table. I need a wingman."
"You've lost your mind, Jake."
"Come on, pal. Think of all the crazy stuff I've done for you."
"Nope. You're on your own. Tomorrow morning, you get another dose of life as a small-town criminal lawyer.
And you're afraid to be seen with me."
"No, I'm afraid of waking up that early." "Beat it, pal. You're making your own decisions these days without regard to others. I'm pissed, and I plan to stay that way for a long time."
"I've heard that before."
"This time I mean it. You want to play radical lawyer? Get your buddy Lucian to join you for breakfast. See how the locals enjoy him."
"He can't get up that early.
And we know why."
With Hannah tucked in for the night and Jake out roaming the streets, Carla watched television and waited on the 10 o'clock news. She started with the Tupelo station where, as expected, the murder of Stuart Kofa was the lead story, with a large color image of the deputy in his nicely starched uniform posted as background. Details were still under wraps. A suspect, a minor, name not given, was in custody. There was footage of an ambulance leaving Kofer's property with, presumably, a dead body inside, but none visible. No comment from the sheriff or anyone else with authority. No comments anywhere, yet the intrepid reporter on the scene managed to ramble on about the killing for a solid 5 minutes, while saying almost nothing. Filler was added with live shots of the Ford County Courthouse and even the jail, where some patrol cars were filmed coming and going. Carla switched to a Memphis station and learned even less. Though for good measure, the story included something vague about a domestic disturbance, with the mild implication that Kofor had been called to the scene to break up a fight and somehow got hit in the crossfire. There was no reporter on the scene to get to the bottom of things. Evidently, a weekend intern at a news desk was ad-libbing. Another Memphis station spent half its time recapping the city's own daily carnage of home invasions, gang wars, and random murders. It then went south to the Kofor story and the real news that, allegedly, he was the first county officer to be killed in the line of duty since a moonshiner shot two deputies in 1922. Not surprisingly, the reporter spun things to give the impression that the county was still rife with illegal whiskey, drugs, and other lawlessness, a far cry from the safe streets of Memphis. Jake walked in during the last report, and Carla turned off the television and briefed him on the others. He wanted some decaf coffee. She brewed a pot, and they had a cup at the breakfast table where the long day had begun. He replayed his conversations with Ozzie, Drew, and Harry Rex, and he confessed that he was not looking forward to the coming week. She was sympathetic, but obviously worried. She wanted the case to simply go away. Chapter 7. After the Sunday night service at Good Shepherd, Reverend McGarry convened a special meeting of the Board of Deacons. 7 of the 12 were present, 4 women and 3 men, and they gathered in the fellowship hall with cookies and coffee. Kira was next door in the small church parsonage with Meg McGarry, the pastor's wife, eating a sandwich for dinner. The young preacher explained that since Kira had no other place to go at the moment, she would be staying with them until... until what? Until a relative showed up to claim her, which didn't appear likely? Until some court somewhere issued an order? Until her mother was discharged and could leave town with her? Regardless, Carol was now an unofficial ward of the church, and she was traumatized and needed professional help. Throughout the afternoon, she had talked of nothing but her mother and brother and her desire to be with them. Meg had called the hospital and talked to an administrator who said that, yes, they could provide a fold-away bed for the girl to stay with her mother. 2 of the lady deacons volunteered to spend the night down the hall in the waiting room. There was a discussion about food, clothing, and school. Charles was of the firm opinion that Kira should not return to classes for at least a few days. She was far too fragile, and there was the near certainty that another student would say something hurtful. It was finally agreed that the school attendance issue would be dealt with on a day-to-day basis. One member of the church taught algebra at the middle school and would talk to the principal. Another member had a cousin who was a child psychologist, and she would inquire about counseling. Plans were formulated, and at 10 o'clock they drove Kira to the hospital, where the staff had arranged a bed next to her mother's. Josie's vitals were normal, and she said she felt okay. Her swollen and bandaged face, though, told another story. A hospital gown was provided for Kira, and when the nurses turned down the lights, she was sitting at her mother's feet. At 5:30 a.m., Jake's alarm clock started making noises. He silenced it with a slap and rolled back under the covers. So far, he had slept little and was not ready to begin his day. He burrowed deep, found Carla's warm body, moved closer, but was met with resistance. He withdrew, opened his eyes, and thought about his newest client sitting in jail, and was about to surrender to the morning when thunder rolled in the distance. A cold front was expected, with potential storms, and perhaps it wasn't safe to venture out. Another reason to sleep more was the desire to avoid the coffee shop on this dark day, when all the chatter and gossip would be about poor Stu Kofor and the teenage thug who murdered him. Yet another reason was the fact that he was not due in court or anywhere else the entire day. As the reasons accumulated, He felt them closing in, smothering him, and eventually he drifted off. Carla wakened him with a pleasant kiss on the cheek and a cup of coffee. Then she was off to rouse Hannah and get her ready for school. After two sips, Jake thought about the newspapers and hopped out of bed. He pulled on some jeans, found the dog, leashed him, and went outside. The morning editions from Tupelo, Jackson, and Memphis were strewn along his drive, and he quickly scanned each. All had the Cofer story on the front page. He tucked them under his arm, made the block, and returned to the kitchen, where he poured more coffee and spread out the papers. The gags were holding. No one was talking. Ozzie wouldn't even confirm that he was the sheriff. Reporters had been shooed away from the crime scene, the jail, the home of Earl and Janet Cofer, and the hospital. Officer Cofer was 33, an Army veteran, single with no children, 4 years as a deputy. The sparse details of his bio were spread thin. The Memphis paper covered the story of Cofer's deadly run-in with some drug dealers 3 years earlier on a rural road near Caraway, a shootout that left the bad guys dead and Lieutenant Cofer only slightly wounded. A bullet grazed his arm, and he refused hospitalization and never missed a day of work. Jake was suddenly in a hurry. He showered, skipped breakfast, kissed his girls goodbye, and headed to the office. He needed to visit the hospital, and it was imperative that he see Drew again. He was convinced the kid was traumatized and needed help, medical as well as legal, but he wanted to pick the right moment for another attorney-client consultation. Evidently, others felt differently. Portia was at her desk, standing, holding the receiver of her phone, looking puzzled. Her customary smile was missing as Jake walked into the office.
"This man just yelled at me," she said.
"Who was it?" She put the receiver away, picked up the Tupelo paper, pointed to the black and white photo of Stuart Cofer, and said,
"Said he was his father. Said his boy got shot yesterday. Shot dead. And that you're the lawyer for the kid who shot him. Talk to me, Jake."
Jake tossed his briefcase onto a chair. "Earl Cofer?"
"That's him. Sounded crazy. Said the kid, Drew somebody, didn't deserve no lawyer. Crazy stuff like that. What's the deal?"
"Have a seat. Is there any coffee?"
"It's brewing."
"Noose appointed me to the case yesterday. I met with the kid last night at the jail. So, yes, our little law firm now represents a 16-year-old boy who will probably be indicted for capital murder."
"What about the public defender?"
"He couldn't defend a bully in kindergarten, and everybody, especially Noose, knows it. He called around and couldn't find anyone else, and he thinks, I know what I'm doing." Portia sat down, tossed the newspaper aside, and said,
"I like it. This will really liven up the place. Almost 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, and we've already had our first nasty phone call."
"There will probably be others."
"Does Lucian know?"
"I haven't told him. And Noose is promising that he'll replace me in 30 days. Just wants me to handle the preliminary stuff."
"Did the boy shoot him?"
"He didn't talk much. In fact, he clammed up and went into a daze. I think he needs some help. Based on what Ozzie said, he shot him once in the head with his own gun."
Did you know Cofer?"
"I know all the cops, some better than others. Cofer seemed to be a good guy, a friendly sort. Last month he spoke to Carla's sixth graders about drugs, and she said he was wonderful."
"Not a bad-looking boy for a white guy."
"I'm going to the hospital in about an hour to see the kid's mother. Looks like Cofer may have knocked her around some before his big moment. You want to go?" Portia finally smiled and said,
"Of course. I'll get you some coffee."
"What a good little secretary you are."
"I'm a paralegal / research assistant, soon to be law student, and before you know it, I'll be a full-blown partner around here, and you'll be fetching me coffee. One milk, two sugars."
"I'll write that down." Jake climbed the stairs to his office and took off his jacket. He had just settled into his leather swivel when Lucian arrived before the coffee.
Heard you got a new case, he said with a smile, as he fell into a chair,
one that he still owned, because he owned all the other furniture as well as the building itself. Jake's office, the grandest one, had belonged to Lucian before he was disbarred in 1979, and to his father before he was killed in a plane crash in 1965, and to his grandfather, who built the Wilbanks firm into a powerhouse until Lucian took over and ran off all the paying clients. Jake should have been surprised that Lucian knew, but he wasn't. Like Harry Rex, Lucian seemed to hear the hottest news first, though both had entirely different sources. Noose appointed me, Jake said. I didn't want the case. Still don't.
And why not? I need some coffee.
Usually on a Monday morning, Lucian did not bother with pushing himself out of bed, showering and shaving and putting on semi-respectable clothes. Since he couldn't practice law, his Mondays were normally spent on the porch trying to drink off the weekend's hangover. The fact that he was awake and fairly presentable meant he wanted details.
It's coming, Jake said.
Who told you?
A worthless question that was never answered.
Sources, Jake, sources. And why don't you want the case?
Harry Rex is afraid it might somehow damage the Smallwood settlement.
What settlement?
He thinks they're getting ready to put money on the table. He also thinks that this killing could damage my stellar reputation as a noted trial lawyer. He thinks the public will turn on me and we won't be able to pick fair and open-minded jurors.
When did Harry Rex become an expert on juries?
He thinks he's an expert on people.
I wouldn't let him in front of my jury.
That's my job. I have the charisma.
And the ego. And right now, your ego is telling you that you're far more popular than you really are. Defending this kid will not affect your railroad case.
I'm not sure. Harry Rex thinks otherwise.
Harry Rex can be stupid.
He's a brilliant lawyer who happens to be my co-counsel in what just might be the biggest case of our struggling careers. You don't agree with him?
I seldom do. Sure, you'll take some heat for defending an unpopular client, but what the hell? Most of my clients were unpopular, but that didn't mean they were bad people. I didn't care what these yokels thought about me or them. I had a job to do, and it was completely unrelated to the gossip in the coffee shops and churches. They may talk about you behind your back, but when they get in trouble, they'll want a lawyer who knows how to fight, and fight dirty if necessary. When's the kid going to court?
I have no idea, Lucian. I plan to talk to the DA and to Judge Noose this morning. There's also the matter of youth court.
Not a youth court matter. Not in this backward state.
I know the law, Lucian.
A charge of murder is automatically excluded from youth court jurisdiction.
I know the law, Lucian. Portia opened the door and eased in with coffee and cups on a tray. Lucian continued his lecture.
It really doesn't matter how young the kid is, either. 20 years ago, they put a 13-year-old on trial for murder down in Polk County. I knew his defense lawyer.
Good morning, Lucian,
Portia said politely as she poured coffee.
Morning,
he said without looking at her. In the early days of her employment, he enjoyed long, leering stares. He had touched her a few times, on the arms and shoulders, just little affectionate pats that meant nothing. But after some stern warnings from Jake and a direct threat of bodily harm from Portia, he had backed off and grown to admire her.
We had another call, Jake, about 5 minutes ago, she said. Anonymous. Some hick said, if you tried to get this boy off like you got that Haley nigger off, there would be hell to pay.
I'm sorry he said that, Portia, Jake said, stunned.
It's okay. I've heard it before, and I'm sure I'll hear it again.
I'm sorry too, Portia,
Lucian said softly.
Real sorry.
Jake waved at a wooden chair next to Lucian, and she sat down. In unison, they sipped their coffee and thought about the N-word. 12 years earlier, when Jake finished law school and arrived in Clanton as the rookie, the word was commonly used by white lawyers and judges as they gossiped and told jokes, and even did their business without an audience.
Now, though, in 1990, its usage was fading and it was deemed improper, even low class, to use it. Jake's mother hated the word and had never allowed it, but growing up in Caraway, Jake knew that his home was different in that respect. He looked at Portia, who at the moment seemed less bothered than the two men, and said, "I'm really sorry you heard that in this office."
"Hey, I'm okay. I've heard it my entire life. I heard it in the army. I'll hear it again. I can deal with it, Jake. But just to clear the air here, all the players involved are white, right?"
"Yes."
"So we shouldn't expect the cluckers and those guys to show up like Haley, right?"
"Who knows?" Lucian said. "There are plenty of nuts out there."
"You got that right. Not yet 9 on a Monday morning and 2 calls are ready. 2 threats."
"What was the first one?" Lucian asked.
"The father of the deceased, a man named Earl Kofer," Jake said. "I've never met him, but it looks like that might change."
"The father of the deceased called the lawyer of the person arrested for the killing?"
Jake and Portia nodded. Lucian shook his head. Then he smiled and said,
"I love it. Makes me wish I was back in the trenches."
The desk phone rang, and Jake stared at it. Line 3 was blinking, and that usually meant Carla was calling. He slowly lifted the receiver, said hello, and listened. She was at school in her classroom, first period. The secretary in the principal's office down the hall had just answered the phone, and a man who refused to give his name asked if Jake Brigance's wife worked there. He said he was a good friend of Stuart Kofer, said Kofer had a lot of friends and that they were upset because Carl Lee Haley's lawyer was now trying to get that kid out of jail, said jail was the only thing keeping the boy alive at the moment. When she asked his name for the second time, he hung up. The secretary informed the principal, who told Carla, then called the city police. When Jake wheeled to a stop in front of the school, he parked behind 2 patrol cars. An officer named Step Lemon, a former bankruptcy client of Jake's, was at the front door and greeted Jake like an old friend. Lemon said,
"The call came from a payphone at Parker Stowe down by the lake. That's as far as we can dig. I'll get Ozzy to ask around at the Stowe, but my guess is it's a waste of time."
Jake said, "Thanks." And they stepped inside where the principal was waiting with Carla, who seemed thoroughly unflustered by the phone call. She and Jake walked away for some privacy.
"Hannah's fine," Carla whispered. "They checked on her right away, and she knows nothing."
"The asshole called the school where he worked," Jake whispered.
"Watch your language. It's just some nut, Jake."
"I know, but nuts can do stupid things. We've had 2 calls at the office already.
Do you think it'll blow over?"
"No. There are too many big events just around the corner. The boy's first court appearance, Kofer's funeral, more court appearances, and one day there might be a trial."
"But you're just temporary, right?"
"Right. I'll see Noose tomorrow and tell him what's going on. He can find another lawyer from outside the county. You're okay?"
"I'm fine, Jake. You didn't have to race over here."
"Yes, I did." He walked out of the building with Officer Lemon, shook hands with him, and thanked him again, and got in his car. Instinctively, he slid back the lid of his console to make sure his automatic pistol was still there. It was, and he cursed it, and shook his head in frustration as he drove away. At least 1,000 times in the past 2 years, he had vowed to put his firearms away and retrieve them only for hunting. But the gun nuts were loose and more rabid than ever. It was safe to assume that in the rural South, every vehicle had a weapon. Old laws had made it necessary to hide them, but newer ones had brought them out into the open. Get a permit these days, and you could hang rifles in your rear window and strap a 6-shooter on your hip. Jake despised the idea of keeping guns in his car, his desk at work, his nightstand at home. But once they take shots at you, burn your house, and threaten your family, notions of self-preservation become priority 1. Chapter 8. A Mrs. Whitaker and a Mrs. Huff introduced themselves in the third floor waiting room and asked if Jake and Portia would like something to eat. The Good Shepherd Bible Church was in the process of laying siege. The coffee tables and counters were covered with food, and more was on the way. Mrs. Huff explained that the ladies of the church were working shifts now, keeping a watchful eye on Josie Gamble down the hall in that room with the bored deputy sitting outside the door in a rocker. As Mrs. Huff talked, Mrs. Whitaker placed two thick slices of triple fudge cake on paper plates and handed one to Portia and one to Jake. Since it was not physically possible to decline the cake, they took small bites with plastic forks as Mrs. Huff went through the results of Josie's latest tests with no respect for privacy. When Jake was finally allowed to speak and told them that he was the court-appointed lawyer for Drew, the ladies were visibly impressed and offered coffee. Jake introduced Portia as his paralegal, but it wasn't clear if they knew what that meant. Mrs. Whitaker said her nephew was a lawyer over in Arkansas, and not to be outdone, Mrs. Huff said her brother had once served on a grand jury. The cake was delicious, and Jake asked for another, smaller slice and accepted some coffee to wash it down. When he glanced at his watch, Mrs. Whitaker informed him that Josie's door was closed because she was being examined by her doctors. It wouldn't take long, she assured him, as if she was now well-versed on hospital procedures. Since both ladies seemed hell-bent on talking nonstop, Jake sat down and began asking questions about the Gamble family. Mrs. Whitaker got the jump on her rival and explained that they, mother and children, had been worshiping at Good Shepherd for the past few months. One of the deacons, Mr. Herman Vest, they thought it was, had met Josie where she worked at the car wash in Clanton and struck up a conversation, as he was prone to do. Mr. Vest enjoyed meeting new people and inviting them to church. Mr. Vest, if it was indeed him, had passed along her name to their pastor, Brother Charles, and he had followed up with a home visit, one that reportedly did not go well, because the man of the house, Officer Stuart Cofer, may he rest in peace, had been quite rude to their pastor. Additionally, it was obvious that Josie was living with the man without the benefit of holy matrimony, living in open sin, so that gave them all additional ammo for their prayer lists. Nevertheless, Josie and the kids visited one Sunday morning. The church always took great pride in welcoming visitors. That was one reason its enrollment had almost doubled since Brother Charles had arrived. One big, happy family. Mrs. Huff barged in at this point because she had something special to offer. Kira at the time was only 13 years old, 14 now, and Mrs. Huff taught the young teenage girls in a Sunday school class. Once Mrs. Huff, as well as the rest of the church, came to realize what awful things Josie and the kids had been through, they really took them in. Mrs. Huff had a special interest in Kira, who at first was extremely shy and introverted. But once a month, Mrs. Huff invited the class to her house for pizza, ice cream, and a scary movie sleepover, and she coaxed Kira into joining them. The other girls were terrific. Some knew her from school, but she had a difficult time relaxing at the little party. Portia had put down her cake and was taking notes. When Mrs. Huff paused for a breath, Portia pounced with, "When you say the family had been through some awful things, what do you mean, if you don't mind telling us?" These two women would tell anything, but they did glance at each other as if thinking perhaps they should throttle back. Mrs. Huff said,
"Well, when they were younger, they were separated. Not sure how or why, but I think Josie, and she is a dear, had to go away, maybe got in some trouble, you know. The kids were sent away, something like that."
Mrs. Whitaker added,
"Drew's teacher said the class was doing pen pal letters to boys and girls in orphanages, and Drew said he'd been there once to an orphanage, and he wasn't ashamed to talk about it." Seems like he's more outgoing than his sister.
Any family around here? Jake asked. Both ladies shook their heads, no. Mrs. Huff said,
And I'm not sure about why she took up with that Kofor fellow. He had a bad reputation in the area.
For what? Portia asked.
Well, there were a lot of rumors about the guy down our way. Even though he was a deputy, he had a darker side.
Jake was keen to pursue the dark side when a doctor walked in. The ladies proudly introduced him to the family's lawyer and his paralegal. As in most hospitals, the presence of a lawyer chilled the conversation with the doctor. He assured them the patient was doing fine, still in pain, but getting restless. Once the swelling was under control, they would do the surgery to reset the broken bones in her cheek and jaw. Can she talk? Jake asked.
A little. She struggles, but she wants to talk.
Could we see her?
Sure. Just don't overdo it, okay?
Jake and Portia hurried from the room as Mrs. Whitaker and Mrs. Huff were pointing the doctor toward the latest casseroles and talking about lunch. It was 10:20. The deputy on hall duty was Lyman Price, probably the oldest member of Ozzy's force, and the one least able to stalk drug dealers and chase down criminals. When he wasn't pushing papers around his desk at the jail, he worked the courtrooms, keeping order in the court. Killing hours outside a hospital room was another perfect job for old Lyman. He greeted Jake with his usual gruffness, with no hint of an edge because of the Kofor business. Jake knocked on the door as he opened it and smiled at Kira, who was sitting in a chair reading a teen magazine. Josie was on her back, but propped up and alert. Jake introduced himself and Portia and said hello to Kira, who put down the magazine and stood near her mother's feet. Jake said they would just be there for a moment, but he had met with Drew the night before and promised him that he would see his mother and make sure she was okay. She grabbed his hand and squeezed it, and through the gauze mumbled something like,
How is he?
He's okay. We're on our way back to the jail to see him now. Kira had moved closer and was sitting on the edge of the bed. Her eyes were moist, and she wiped her cheeks. And Jake was struck by the fact that she was much taller than her brother, though 2 years younger. Drew could pass for a little boy, far away from puberty. Kira was physically mature for her age.
How long in jail?
Josie asked. A long time, Josie. There's no way to get him out for weeks or months. He'll be charged with murder and face a trial, and that'll take a lot of time. Kira leaned forward with a tissue and wiped her mother's cheeks, then wiped her own. There was a long silent pause as a monitor beeped and nurses laughed in the hallway. Jake flinched first and was suddenly eager to leave. He clutched Josie's hand, leaned down and said, I'll be back. Right now we're going to check on Drew. She tried to nod, but the pain hit and she grimaced. Backing away, Jake handed Kira a business card and whispered, There's my number. At the door, he turned around for a last glance and saw the two clutching each other in a tight embrace, both crying, both terrified of the unknowns. It was a heartbreaking image that he would never forget. Two little people facing nothing but fear and the wrath of the system, a mother and daughter, who'd done nothing wrong, but were suffering mightily. They had no voice, no one to protect them, no one but Jake. A voice told him that they, along with Drew, would be a part of his life for years to come. The chief prosecutor for the 22nd Judicial District, Polk, Ford, Tyler, Milburn, and Van Buren counties, was the district attorney Lowell Dyer from the even smaller town of Gretna, 40 miles north of Clanton. 3 years earlier, Dyer had challenged the great Rufus Buckley, the three-term DA, who many believed would one day become governor, or at least try. With as much ceremony, publicity, grandstanding, and outright hot-dogging as the state had ever seen, Buckley had prosecuted Carl Lee Haley 5 years earlier and begged the jury for death. Jake convinced them otherwise and handed Buckley his greatest defeat. The voters then gave him another one, and he limped back to his hometown of Smithfield and opened a small office. Jake and virtually every other lawyer in the district had quietly supported Lowell Dyer, who had proven to be a steady hand at a rather dull job. Monday morning was anything but dull. Dyer had taken a call late Sunday night from Judge Noose, and the two had discussed the Kofor case. Ozzie called early Monday morning, and by 9 a.m., Dyer was meeting with his assistant, D.R. Musgrove, to consider their options. From the outset, there was little doubt that the state wanted to push for a capital murder indictment and seek the death penalty. A man of the law had been murdered in his own bed, by his own gun, in cold blood. The killer had confessed and was in custody, and though only 16, he was certainly old enough to know right from wrong and appreciate the nature of his actions. In Dyer's world, the good book taught an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Or something like that. The exact wording from the Bible was really not that important because capital punishment was still favored by an overwhelming majority of the population, especially those concerned enough to vote. Polls and public opinion surveys were of no consequence in the rural South, because the issue had long since been settled and public sentiment had not changed. Indeed, when Dyer ran for office, he said several times on the stump that the problem with the gas chamber was that it was not being used enough. This had really pleased the crowds, or at least the white ones. In black churches, he had avoided the issue altogether. The law currently considered murder to be exempt from youth court jurisdiction if the accused was at least 13 years old. A 12-year-old could not be prosecuted in circuit court, the tribunal for all criminal prosecutions. No other state had such a low threshold. In most, the defendant had to be at least 16 to be tried as an adult. Up north, a few states had bumped the age up to 18. But not in the South. Though the gravity of the moment throttled his enthusiasm, Lowell was secretly delighted to have such an important case. In his 3 years, he had not indicted anyone for capital murder, and as a prosecutor who saw himself getting tougher and tougher, he had grown frustrated with such a bland docket. If not for the production and peddling of drugs and the gambling sting run by the feds with local help, he'd have little to do. He had tried a drunk in Polk County for vehicular homicide and put him away for 20 years. He had won 2 bank robberies in Milburn County, same defendant, but the guy had escaped and was still on the lam, probably still robbing banks. Before the Kofor killing, Lowell was spending his time on a joint task force of prosecutors trying to fight the cocaine plague. But with the Kofor killing, Lowell Dyer was suddenly the man in the middle. Unlike his predecessor, Rufus Buckley, who would have already called at least 2 press conferences, Lowell avoided the reporters Monday morning and went about his business. He spoke to Ozzie again, and Noose, and he placed a call to Jake Brigance, but got voicemail. Out of respect, he called Earl Kofor and passed along his sympathies while promising a full measure of justice. He sent his investigator to Clanton to start digging. And he took a call from a pathologist at the state crime lab. The autopsy revealed that Kofor died of a single bullet wound to the head, in through the left temple, out through the right ear. Nothing really remarkable but for the fact that his blood alcohol level was 0.36. 0.36! 3.5 times the state's limit of 0.10 to be legally drunk behind the wheel. Kofor was 6 feet 1 inch tall and weighed 197 pounds. A man that size and that drunk would have a difficult time doing anything, walking, driving, even breathing. As a small-town lawyer with 15 years' experience, Lowell had never seen or heard of a case involving such a high level of alcohol. He expressed disbelief and asked the pathologist to test the blood again. Lowell would review the autopsy report as soon as he received it, and in due course, he would hand it over to the defense. There would be no way to conceal the fact that Stuart Kofer was blind drunk when he died. No set of facts was ever perfect. Every prosecution, as well as every defense, had its flaws in the proof. But for a deputy to be so raging drunk at 2 in the morning presented a lot of questions. And just hours after landing the case of a lifetime, Lowell Dyer had his first doubt. Jake dropped Portia off at the square and drove to the jail. It was still busier than usual, and he did not want to go inside and face the stairs. But as he parked on the street, he said to himself, "What the hell? You can't defend a cop killer and still be loved by the cops." If they resented Jake for doing his job, a job that no one else wanted but had to be done, then he couldn't worry about it. He entered the front room, where the deputies liked to kill time, gossiping and drinking gallons of coffee, and said hello to Marshall Prather and Moss Jr. Tatum. They nodded because they had to, but within seconds, Jake realized the battle lines had been drawn. "Is Ozzie in?" he asked Tatum, who shrugged as if he had no clue. Jake kept walking and stopped at Doreen's desk. She was Ozzie's secretary and guarded his door like a Doberman. She also wore a full uniform and carried a gun,